Hi, everybody. Bob Claster here. I'm the host of Funny Stuff, which airs on Friday nights here on KCRW, but this is a special broadcast. If you had found out that there was a new detective novel, which was about time travel, ghosts, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, computers, and the extinction of the dodo, you'd probably guess correctly that the author is Douglas Adams, who's my guest today here on KCRW. Douglas Adams is one of the more clever ape-descended life forms on this or any other galaxy. He's the author of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which started out as a radio series, then became a TV series, and lastly a trilogy consisting of four books. He's also the author of two interactive computer novels published by Infocom, The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy and the just-released Bureaucracy, and has a new novel out called Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency, published by Simon & Schuster. Douglas, welcome back to KCRW.
Thanks, Bob. Nice to be here.
Yeah, you've been here for the Castaway's Choice.
That's right. Yeah, it was a while ago. I'm trying to remember what it was I chose.
Well, I hope you left that island in good condition. You're reported to have over 8 million books in print. Are you surprised by the degree of success that you've had?
Well, you kind of have to be, really. It started out as a radio series. I mean, it's not a common path, to go from radio series to bestseller. Though, actually, it's happened again in England, actually. Though I don't think it's reached America yet. There's a woman called Sue Townsend who wrote a book for she wrote something for radio, which then turned into a book. It was called The Secret Diary of Adrian Mole, Aged 13 and 3 Quarters, which became an immense bestseller in England and sold millions of copies, much more than me, in fact. But I don't think it's made it over here yet. There's a great correlation, you see, between people who listen to the radio and people who read books, much greater than people who watch television and read books.
Mm-hmm.
Because most people who watch television, their brains are thereby turned bean curd. They are no longer able to read as a result.
Well, also, once you get really tuned into television, you don't have time to read.
No, right.
We just finished running the series again here, and every time we run it, it just gets more and more popular, and there are more and more questions. I know you're probably sick to death of Hitchhiker's questions, but there are a few that people want to know. First of all, why was the character of Trillian dropped after the first series of six?
I just felt that I hadn't really sort of done anything very much with her, and it hadn't hadn't seemed to sort of go anywhere. I couldn't think of any way of revivifying the character. Mm-hmm. So I just thought, well, let it go.
And the last time you were here and talking with me, you mentioned that Jeffrey McGivern, who played Ford Prefect, had disappeared.
Yeah.
Has he been found?
Yes, but he's disappeared again.
Oh.
he's been found and disappeared twice in the last 4 years. He leads a somewhat eccentric life these days. And it's sad, because he's a very, very brilliant, sparky, extraordinary guy. But, life, I'm afraid, just sort of gets too much for him from time to time, and he just sort of goes walkabout, and you discover him living as a tramp somewhere, or doing something strange, and he suddenly sort of gets back into life, and everybody immediately sort of rallies round and sort of finds him parts to do and in shows and things, and you're always sort of touching wood that he's actually going to turn up and do it, and then suddenly one day he won't turn up and do it, and he will have disappeared again.
It sounds more like Zaphod Beeblebrox.
Right, yeah, I guess so.
When last we spoke, you said there were plans for a Hitchhiker's Guide movie.
Yes.
Did you write a script for it?
I wrote several scripts for it. I actually lived here in Los Angeles in 1983, writing scripts for it. I think what happened was that for 4 years, basically, I've been told we're about to make the movie, it's about to go into production, we're definitely making it. It's just we haven't got the right director yet. We're looking for the right director. Then a little while ago, I was told, well, there's some good news and some bad news. The good news is we've got a director. We have a director on board, on the staff, contracted, everything's fine. The bad news is we're no longer making the movie. Columbia, since David Putnam took over, another Englishman, has decided to put it into turnaround. And so, actually, I'm not allowed to say what's going to happen next. The director, or directors, I should say, it's a pair of directors, Rocky Morton and Annabelle Jankel, who
From
were the original...
Max Headroom.
That's right, yeah. And they're great, actually. It's funny, I hadn't actually seen the original Max Headroom. Well, I had hardly seen Max Headroom at all, but I hadn't seen the original show from which it all came until I was told they were going to be directing, and I was sent round a copy of the videotape. And I really thought it was great. I felt very much at home with it. I thought, this is an approach I would be extremely happy with. But, it's the processes of Hollywood, which we just sort of watch with a certain amount of astonishment.
See the silver screen. Huh?
It may do.
Considering the success of Hitchhiker's Guide in its various incarnations, you showed remarkable restraint in regards to merchandising. Did you get many truly bizarre offers?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is that, I mean, the one thing I do, the one piece of merchandising we have done, that isn't actually some sort of creative thing like the computer game or whatever. Something I was very, very fond of, which was the Hitchhiker bath towel, which is on sale in England. It's done very well as far as my royalties are concerned. I think I'm already into my second pound.
How does it differ from a normal towel? Or?
It has the text of the Hitchhiker's towel speech woven into it. Mm. And it's a really nice object, actually. It's a good, solid, thick, good quality towel with this speech woven into it.
And does Marks and Spencer sell
makes
it?
An absorbing read. No, it's just on sale in mail order from this little company run by a friend of mine. And, it sells a few dozen every now and then, and it ticks over nicely, and I'm really sort of happy about that.
So
actually.
People didn't come to you with totally bizarre offers?
Well, the thing is, there have been a lot of ideas about, marketing some little Marvin dolls and all that kind of thing, but in fact, for a long time, I was never that wild about it anyway. And I know people say, you can make huge amounts of money from doing merchandising, but and if the movie comes out, then probably, I guess, we'll do that. I'm a writer. I'm not a sort of businessman. I'm not a merchandiser. And there was a little bit of sort of strategy there, which was that since the movie was continually imminent, one didn't want to do little Marvin dolls that might then be contradicted by whatever the design in the movie was. But I don't mind. I know that merchandising might have made me a zillionaire, but who cares?
So will 8 million books in print, for that matter. Right? I have a little bone to pick for you. Don't you hate it when a recording artist, all of whose albums you have, such as Paul Simon, for instance, puts out a greatest hits album with one new song on?
Yes. Well, there's another.
You know what I'm getting at here.
Well, what was it called? Greatest Hits, Etc., Paul Simon, which had Stranded in a Limousine.
Right. No, but what I'm getting at regarding you is the Hitchhiker's Trilogy book, which contains one new short story.
Oh, right.
So those of us that have all the four books also have to buy this new book to get this one story.
Oh, boy, yes. What can I say? Well, it was just that... I'll tell you where that came from, actually. I was... a thing I did last year in England was I worked for an organization called Comic Relief. Now, I know there's an organization called Comic Relief over here in America. The only connection between the two things is that they do exactly the same thing and have exactly the same name, which is, actually an extremely obvious name, which is why they can't both have the same name. And but there's actually no connection between them at all. And it's simply a collection of comedy writers and performers who... are sort of regularly involved in projects to raise money for Ethiopia and Sudan. It's a continuing effort. And my particular role in all this was to put together a book, which is called The Utterly, Utterly Merry Comic Relief Christmas Book. I contributed a number of things, short stories and stuff, and a lot of other people, members of the Monty Python team and... The Young Ones, which I think are somewhat known in America now, because I think they're shown on MTV, which is a very, very sort of anarchic and violent comedy show. And a whole bunch of other people, we all did contributions to this book, which raised $1 million. I did two short 2.5 short stories and a number of other bits and pieces. And the one thing that everybody had sort of demanded from me was that I write a hitchhiker short story, obviously. And I did it sort of somewhat reluctantly. But I put it in there. And then suddenly my American publishers are saying, we need something to go in this book. You've got to put something extra in this book. So I let them have that story.
Mm. Are you completely done with Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Yes. I would accept that... there will probably be a second Hitchhiker computer game. I think I finally agreed to do that, though I've been putting it off for a long time. But that really will be the bitter end. It's just that the thing is, you know, I've done it for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done the author tours for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, and you just need to do sort of fresh and different things.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, this new book is a new departure, and I'm doing something wildly, radically different next year, which is I'm doing, it's going to be a radio series, it's going to be a wildlife radio series. You blink in astonishment, yes.
A straight wildlife radio series?
Well, ish. A couple of years ago, I was asked by the Observer newspaper in London and the World Wildlife Fund to go on an expedition to Madagascar to see if I could find... I went with a zoologist from the fund and a photographer to see if we could find a creature called the aye-aye, which is a nearly extinct form of lemur and one of the rarest animals in the world. Hardly anybody's ever seen one in the wild, and there hasn't been one in the zoo for many years, though I think there's one now in Paris. It was one of the most extraordinary, exciting and stimulating experiences that I've ever been through in my life. And still remains some a sort of huge sort of magic memory of everything that happened there. And my qualification for the trip was that I knew nothing about it whatsoever, but was a known writer
mm-hmm.
who could go with a fresh perspective. And but I learned an awful lot while I was there. I was just sort of traipsing through the rainforest and sort of living in little huts in the rainforest looking for this creature. And there was... myself and the zoologist named Mark Carwardian, and so he was actually explaining an awful lot of the things that we were seeing as we went along and how the rainforest worked. And and then, you know, every now and then we'd finally get to some sort of little town where we'd sort of sit in the bar for the evening and sort of discuss everything that had happened, and there were all the sort of characters we met and everything. And I kept on thinking, God, I wish we could put this on tape. This is wonderful stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And sort of stuff you could never, ever do on television because, you know, you've just got to have it happening, have it taped as it happens. And he and I started planning from then that as soon as we had time, which is effectively next year, we're going to go on a series of such expeditions all around the world, Australia, New Zealand, Indonesia, Vietnam, Guatemala and Brazil are the particular places we're going to. And... in each place, we've identified a particular rare or endangered animal we're going to go and look for. And we're going to tape the whole thing as we go. And, you know, we hope it's going to be extremely funny and entertaining as well, because most travel is, if you can manage to maintain your sense of humor through the sort of trials and tribulations and catastrophes that occur to you. And then we're going to do a book based on it. And so that'll be quite a fair bit of next year. So you don't know what to say to that, do you?
No, it sounds fascinating. I hope we get it through the BBC because we get a lot of stuff through them. Hitchhiker's Guide started out as a radio program, then became record albums, a television show, and finally a series of books. Will Dirk Gently make the same journey in reverse and end up as radio?
I don't know. I mean, one of the things I'm keen not to do is to allow it... I mean, obviously, I mean, I'd love it if it was a huge success and everybody likes the book and so on. If it goes to movie or television or radio, I want to try and make myself find somebody I'm prepared to trust to do it and be prepared to delegate, because I don't want to do what I've been doing for years with Hitchhiker, which is every word you write has then got to be rewritten for this medium and another medium and a computer game and so on. And you know, you just become a sort of... you become an industry rather than a writer. And I'd much rather, having written this book, and I feel that I'm very happy to sort of move in a new direction, and I had a lot of fun writing it, and I think I learnt a lot writing it, and I think I can now see what else I have to learn next in order to become better at writing. And I now want to become a better and better writer, if I possibly can. Mm-hmm. And I think the way to do that is to concentrate primarily, you know, on writing books, maybe doing other things along the way, as much as anything else, just to have different input coming in. So, and that's one of the reasons for going and doing this wildlife expedition, because I just want different input.
Yeah.
But I don't want to, you know, turn it all into this industry again, when I should actually be learning to be a better writer by doing another book and then another book and so on.
Any chance you'll write another radio series? I mean, actually write one as opposed to record one on Safari?
Who knows?
There are a lot of people that write wonderful books, but there are very few people that write wonderful radio series.
It's very odd, you know, because very often when I do interviews, somebody will often sort of introduce the interview with a little extract, and it's almost always the same extracts, which I now am very, very sort of used to. And it's funny, I did I did an interview in a radio station in Philadelphia the other day, and they played, actually it wasn't something from the radio series even, it was an extract of the soundtrack of the television series, which is an odd thing to have done. And it was right at the very, very end of the series. And I hadn't heard it for ages and ages and ages. And I was also hearing it sort of somewhat afresh because it was the sound without the picture. And I sat there sort of listening to it. And I was really sort of quite moved by it in an odd kind of way. I began to feel sort of a bit sort of blinky. And I suddenly thought, God, that is such a great medium, radio, and just sound. And it's a bit when they just realize, you know, they're stuck there and, the Earth is going to come to an end again in 2 million years' time. And Ford says something about, well, you know, I've heard of worse fates. You know, there was a planet off in the seventh dimension that got used as a ball and, you know, came into galactic bar billiards, got potted straight into a black hole, killed 7 billion people, and only scored 30 points. And then you could get the sort of sound of the Louis Armstrong singing it, What a Wonderful World, coming in. And I was really sort of terribly sort of moved by it. And I thought, you know, you can't, there's an effect there that you can't get in any other medium than radio. And it is great. And I've actually become very interested also recently in sound technology. I mean, you won't be surprised to hear that, having read the book. And I suppose I now have, I mean, because of the degree to which sound technology has moved on in the last 10 years, I mean, I now have sort of synthesizer stuff at home that's probably at least the equal of what the whole radiophonic workshop had 10 years ago when we were doing the thing. And so, you know, I'm beginning to sort of, I'm tinkering with all that with a sort of increasing sense of what might be done with it.
No, we'd love it if you would.
Yeah.
How did you get the idea for this new book, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency?
Well, it's not so much a question of getting the idea, it's the ideas, because I was oscillating between an awful lot of different ideas that would make the center of a book, and I suddenly realized, well, I'm having difficulty in deciding which of them to go for. But in fact, you need an awful lot of ideas for a book. Mm-hmm. It isn't just one. So I'd put them all together. Because at one stage, I wanted to write a detective story. Then I thought, actually, what I'd like to do is a ghost story and tell a ghost story from the point of view of the ghost. It always gets a bad press. In the mythology of ghosts, they're always represented as being malevolent, irrational beings. Mm-hmm. Just as we tend to regard people whose motives and conditions of life or culture we don't understand as being malevolent and irrational beings. And it's only simply because we don't understand things from their point of view. And so I thought it would be interesting to see poltergeist activity from the other side and see that this is a guy just trying to handle stuff and trying to work out how he can survive.
Yeah, I love your explanation of why ghosts do haunt us.
And
finally makes some sense.
And then I thought I was also very interested in getting the sort of computers into it because I've just become so obsessed with sort of computers. And in the end, I thought, well, I'll just put it all in. And I decided what I'm writing here is a ghost horror detective whodunit time travel romantic musical comedy epic, which is a whole new genre. genre, and Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency is at the moment the first and only example of this genre.
Well, you end the book with "To be continued." Is this the first in a series?
Well, I'm going to do one more. I may do more. But at the moment, I just plan to do one more.
Which of the characters will be back?
I think probably just Dirk. Maybe the character Richard Macduff, simply because I continue to be interested in the sort of computer side of things. And I've got one or two ideas there.
It's too bad, because I was crazy about Reg. He was my favorite character.
Oh, right. Well, I very deliberately sort of got rid of the time machine thing at the end, because I was always slightly reluctant to put... No. I was always slightly reluctant to put a time machine into a story, simply because any plot which involves time travel in the end cannot make complete sense.
Right.
There is an inherent illogic that you'll never... You can only put a smokescreen around. You
but
can't actually...
it's such
actually
a wonderful mental exercise. Anyway.
But it was... The reason the time machine had to be there was because I'd always wanted to do the Coleridge idea of some... The story.
You don't
the
give
person,
away too much.
I don't want to give the book away. But there was a scene I wanted to do, which I'd really wanted to do for years and years and years. And the only way of doing it involved having a time machine, so the time machine had to be there. But because I was reluctant to put it in, that's why I definitely get rid of it right at the end of the story. And the sequel will not have a time machine in it. No, the thing is, it's going to the sequel, and if there are sequels to the sequel, which I don't rule out, but I don't say there will be either, will not be sequels in the same sense that the Hitchhiker books are sequels to each other, where each time I sit down to write the book, I have to work out where all the characters are, where right. I've left them, and try to sort of bring them back together again, and all that kind of thing, which really becomes, you know, quite a chore. And I much prefer, as I had to on this book, starting with a complete blank sheet of paper, saying, well, okay, where do we start, where do we go? So the next Dirk Gently book, and if there are any more, will be again, I start with a blank sheet of paper and build up a whole new set of characters and situation, except that Dirk would be the one who comes in and finds the connections between, you know, apparently completely disparate and unassociated and apparently irrational events.
Given a time machine, what would you do with it? Besides go visit Samuel Taylor
this
Coleridge.
This is... Boy, this is a tricky one. That's quite a...
When I was in high school, I used to draw a picture of a time machine that would get me to the end of the period faster, because I was always terribly bored in school, and I found that drawing the control panel of the time machine usually did get me to the end of the period. But
I think I might go and listen to Bach playing the organ, actually.
Ooh, that's nice.
Either that, or I might go to the first performance of either The Marriage of Figaro or The Magic Flute. Or the recording of Sergeant Pepper.
I read recently that the four-track recorder that was recorded on was auctioned off for something like less than $1,000.
Good God. Well, I know it's been standing in... There's a music store on Tottenham Court Road where they sell tape records and stuff, and it had been an exhibit just in the corner of the store for ages.
I think they got it for a song.
That's amazing, because, I mean, all kinds of Beatles memorabilia sells for extraordinary sums of money. Well, and the idea that the actual recorder they use for doing Sgt. Pepper just goes... That's extraordinary.
It broke my heart to see that. Which takes more time, writing an interactive novel like Bureaucracy or writing a traditional novel like Dirk Gently here?
It's slightly difficult to say, because writing an interactive one, you're not doing all the work, you know, because there are other people involved in actually
coding it
yeah. and doing all that stuff. And also, there are a lot of... in fact, Bureaucracy was actually a lot more collaborative than Hitchhiker, because there are quite a lot of... Once the idea of Bureaucracy had got going, everybody at Infocom kept on coming in saying, oh God, we've got this terrible thing happened to my sister. And
why don't you explain what it is to people?
Well, it's a game which involves, you know, all kinds of escalating adventures and catastrophes. They're just going to get worse and worse, and almost to an extraordinary degree. When in fact, your object in the game is quite simply this: to get your bank to acknowledge a change of address card, and everything else flows from that. And as soon as that idea was sort of floated and got going, everybody would come in and with their own particular tales of grief and woe and frustration. And so there was a lot of input from a lot of different people there. The Hitchhiker, I mean, it was me and Steve Moretzky. The way that would go was this. I mean, I'd just start at the beginning and just start typing in text and designing, you know, the way it branched. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would sort of have to sort of say quite laboriously, you know, if there's this response, we go this way. If there's that response, we go that way. And this happens and that happens. And so I would, as I wrote the stuff, I'd then hand it over to Steve, who would start coding it. And in the coding of it, would then find, you know, things that I hadn't thought of, holes that I'd passed by or would have other thoughts. And he would then start sort of fiddling around with those and come back to me and say, what do you think of this idea? What do you think of that idea? And I would say, fine or not fine, or let's do it that way. And so so I was kind of leading the way into the maze, and Steve was filling out the maze, if you like. Mm-hmm. It's very hard to say how long things take, because very rarely are you actually doing only one thing. It's easier to say with this book, for instance, because, I mean, last year, apart from doing the work, which took a lot longer than I thought it would, on the Comic Relief Christmas book, this was the only other thing I was doing. And I would say that Dirk Gently probably took a year not to write and 3 months then to write. Mm-hmm. But the year of not writing it is the most crucial part of it. Yeah. When you're sitting around thinking and fretting and thinking, oh, God, can I do it? I can't think of anything. Oh, no, let's go and have a bath. Let's
At the start of The Hitchhiker's Guide, The World Ends. At the end of Dirk Gently, the world is saved from destruction. I don't think I'm giving away too much with that by saying so. Did you do this to atone?
It's funny. I told myself very strictly after I'd finished Dirk Gently, the next book I write, the climax of it, there's a nub of the story, will surround what happens to a person rather than what happens to the world, because I'm fed up with the world. Mm-hmm. You know, it's too big a thing, and therefore becomes, in a sense, too small a thing, whereas I think it'd be nice to be more personally engaged with a particular person. So, no, there wasn't... It wasn't to atone, though, I must say. Whenever anybody asks me you know, if they want to start out as a writer, say, have you got any advice for writers, I have a simple answer, which is, yes, do not blow up the world in chapter one, because you're going to need it later. I mean, one of the problems always with Hitchhiker, and it was particularly strong a problem for me, was that... I had got rid of reference points. Now, when I say that was an important problem for me, I think where I tend to work best and tend to find the most fertile area is where the very, very fantastical and extraordinary abuts up against the very, very ordinary and everyday and mundane. Because you need the everyday and the ordinary to give substance and reality to the fantasy, and make you actually think and believe that this fantastical thing is actually happening. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, Hitchhiker, you know, I'd got rid of the world, you know, the world right at the beginning of the first book. And so the only representative of ordinariness was Arthur Dent. And by the time he's been wandering around the galaxy for a few years, he's no longer our representative out there, because his experience by that stage is utterly different from ours.
Right.
So I'd actually run out of ordinary touchstones to put the fantastical things up against. So that was why Hitchhiker really had to finish.
Well, when they end up back on the Earth 2 million years in the past, I was wondering if it was the Earth Mark 1 or the Earth Mark 2 that they ended up on.
One.
Well, that's what I figured. We don't really want to give away too much of the new book, but maybe as a teaser you might explain the concept of the electric monk.
The electric monk is a labor-saving device. It would have been very useful for us in England in the last couple of months, and it will be very useful to you in America next year for reasons I'll explain. It is a labor-saving device, just as we have dishwashers that will wash tedious dishes for you and thus save you the bother of doing it yourself. Just as we have video recorders that will record tedious television programs and thus save you the bother of watching them yourself. I watch television for you. So the electric monk is a labor-saving device that will actually believe things for you. And during an election period, just as we've had and you're about to have, the number of things you're asked to believe, I mean, it really gets too much like hard work. And so the electric monk is a device that will simply believe things for you.
It's a delightful concept, and there are many delightful concepts in the book. We're in a tough position because most of our listeners by now, since the book has just come out, haven't had a chance to read it. I hate to give too much of it away and discuss too much of it, but take my word for it, it is a delightful book. Do you have a grand ambition, something something you're working up to that you don't think you're quite up to at this point, but that, you know, your symphony, your grand opera?
I'd like to be. I actually do want to do some music. One of the interesting things that's happened recently is that now I've always been somewhat of a musician for most of my life, but you know, I didn't practice the piano. I didn't practice scales, you know, as I should have done when I was 11. So I've never been a great keyboard player at all. On the other hand, I sang in choirs for years, and one of the great advantages of being male is you get to sing treble, then alto, then tenor, right, then bass in quick succession, and you learn instinctively and empirically a great deal about rhythm, harmony, and counterpoint, and so on.
Are we one? If you're paying attention,
right? Yes, and also you learn obviously, I mean, basics of musical notation, and like most people who grew up in the 60s, I taught myself to play the guitar, but taught myself actually fairly thoroughly, and I'm reasonably good. But it's always been frustrating to me that I'm capable of writing music that I'm not capable of playing, you know, on the keyboard, because I just don't have the keyboard skills. The great thing that now has happened is that with what's known as the MIDI interface, if you get hold of a synthesizer or a bunch of synthesizers, and you connect them up to a computer such as an Apple Macintosh, which is what I use, and if you can write music, you can write it on the screen in musical notation or some other form, or you can enter it bit by bit from the keyboard, and you can build up music which the computer remembers. It's like word processing, only with music. You put as many parts in and as many instruments, and it's like having a whole orchestra at your disposal run from an electronic pianola roll. And suddenly, I mean, you can have an orchestra or a rock band or a jazz band or anything you like. And you can play the whole thing, or rather anything you can think of. The computer will then play according to your instructions. And so I'd like to do a record album. I mean, I sometimes think, yeah, this is absurd. How can you possibly think you can do a record album? But then it's actually less absurd than the idea a few years ago that I could possibly have written a novel. So that's one thing. But otherwise, no, I would just like to become... I'd actually just like to become better at writing books. I mean, I've been very lucky in that, you know, what I've done so far has worked to an extent. But I'm terribly, terribly aware of what is wrong with the books. Mm-hmm. I mean, no bad review ever. A review which is critical and says what's wrong with the book never upsets me at all, because there's nothing that a reviewer can say in criticism of a book that I haven't already thought 100 times myself. But spiteful reviews, as you get occasionally, are really actually quite hurtful. I would actually just like to become a better writer.
Is there a different type of book that you'd like to try to write someday?
I would like to become better at dealing with people, and I sometimes feel I sort of slightly take refuge in a few things that are slightly too gimmicky. There's a difference between a really sort of good solid, clever idea, and an idea that's sometimes just a bit sort of flashy and gimmicky, and I do that from time to time, usually out of sort of lack of confidence with what else I'm doing.
Well, I like the way you deal with that was what I was most impressed with in this book, was that the people really seem fleshed out, and they seem...
Well, I think I'm getting better at it, you know, but it's a sort of slope upwards, you know, so I do feel I'm making progress, but, you know, there's a long way to go.
Well, you've already told us what you're working on now, so all that remains is for you to put on those headphones.
Right.
And I want you to hear, I recently did an interview with John Cleese.
Good heavens.
Put on your headphones.
Yeah.
Can we play the tape?
Douglas Adams writes extremely good, interesting stuff, and he's alarmingly tall. He also is the only really tall man I've ever come across who wears lifts.
No. Are you prepared to deny that here on tape?
There was a period in the in about the mid-70s when it was impossible, unless you were as rich as John Cleese was in those days, to have your shoes made for you, to buy shoes that didn't have lifts. And I think that's probably what he's referring to. Look, honestly, tennis shoes.
Well, Douglas Adams, thank you for joining us. The new book is called Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. I heartily recommend it. It's available from Simon & Schuster in all of your local bookstores on this galaxy. And thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bob.